The White House National Security Advisor says Washington's priority is to deal with what he calls an escalating nuclear crisis with Iran. The World Health Organization experts tasked with investigating the origins of the coronavirus pandemic began field visits in the Chinese city of Wuhan. Also in the headlines, tens of thousands of Indian farmers angry over the government's agricultural policies go on a hunger strike. Thanks for joining us. Top aide to the U.S. President Joe Biden says the new administration's priority is to deal with what he calls an escalating nuclear crisis with Iran. The White House National Security Advisor claimed Tehran is moving, quote, closer to having enough fissile material for a nuclear bomb, or nuclear weapon, I should say. Jake Sullivan made the remarks as the Biden administration has signaled that it wants to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal the previous administration had abandoned. Sullivan did not mention Biden's often stated precondition that Iran make the first move by resuming its full compliance with its commitments under the deal. Iran has underlined that it was the U.S. that unilaterally pulled out of the 2015 deal, and therefore, it needs to take the first step by lifting sanctions and complying with the terms of the agreement. Political commentator Jason Onruha says it was the U.S. that sabotaged the Iran nuclear deal and should not expect the Islamic Republic to comply with the agreement first.
The United States is the one who left the agreement. They are the ones who sabotaged the good faith agreement that existed, yet expects Iran to be the one who makes the gesture, the overture to return to a more stable and peaceful situation. But it was the United States who was the one who actually violated the agreement. So the way that this is phrased is as though Iran did something wrong. Why should Iran trust the United States on a return to the agreement? Why should they have to take the first step when they were not the ones who left it? It was the U.S. People are questioning the commitment and the solidarity that the United States has to the agreement. And even then, Iran has taken no terribly radical action that would place anyone in danger anywhere in the global situation.
Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and Ankara have a common stance that the only way to restore stability in the region is through synergy. Mohammad Javad Zarif hailed his talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu as constructive, friendly, and fruitful. Zarif also noted the ways to expand bilateral ties, regional cooperation, and the latest developments in Syria, Iraq, and the Caucasus were among the main topics discussed in the talks. Iran's top diplomat made the remarks in a Twitter post at the end of his visit to Turkey.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says it is the duty of the U.S. to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and fulfill its obligations under the accord. In a joint press conference with his Turkish counterpart, Zarif underlined that the moment the United States fulfills its commitments, Iran would be prepared to fulfill ours.
It is the duty of the United States to return to this agreement and to fulfill its obligations. The moment the United States fulfills its commitments, we would prepare to fulfill ours.
Zarif also denounced a U.S. decision last month to slap sanctions on Turkey over the country's purchase of the S-400 Russian air defense system. He said the sanctions have no significance. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zarif hailed relations with Turkey, noting that ties will deepen when the U.S. adopts more reasonable attitudes. For his part, Cavusoglu said, Turkey has always supported the nuclear deal, expressing the hope that the Biden administration would return to the JCPOA and lift sanctions on Iran.
I hope that with the Biden administration, the United States' return to this agreement and cooperation on the nuclear issue is restored. In this way, God willing, the sanctions and embargoes imposed on brotherly Iran are lifted.
Zarif arrived in Turkey as part of a tour of countries of the South Caucasus, aimed at building support for the creation of a regional platform that would include Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, Russia, and Turkey, and encourage cooperation between the countries. The initiative was proposed following a ceasefire agreement in November that halted weeks of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the separatist territory of Nagorno-Karabakh.
I think the meeting was very important. Both sides have a lot in common and many issues were discussed regionally and economically. The most important issue on the agenda was the Iran nuclear deal. And now with the new U.S. administration, there is a hope for this deal to be revived.
Zarif also met with Turkish President Erdogan, where the two discussed expansion of bilateral ties, as well as regional cooperation in Syria, Iraq, Caucasus, and ways to restore stability in the region through synergy. This meeting is seen by many as a door to open negotiations between Turkey and the U.S. to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A team of experts led by the World Health Organization, tasked with investigating the origins of the COVID-19, has begun field visits in the Chinese city of Wuhan after a two-week quarantine. The team paid a visit to one of Wuhan's main hospitals, which treated patients in the early stages of the pandemic. The team is also scheduled to visit labs, markets, and other hospitals during its remaining days in the city. China has warned against any political interference in the mission. The investigators arrived in Wuhan on January 14th. To make sure that they are not exposed to the disease, they spent 14 days in a hotel where they started the probe through online meetings with Chinese scientists. The first known cluster of coronavirus was detected in Wuhan in December 2019. Stephen Rebay joined us earlier to give us the latest details about the WHO-led investigations into the origins of coronavirus pandemic in China.
Today they were driven to the Jinyin Tan Hospital, which received the first officially diagnosed COVID-19 patients at the end of 2019. The team leader, a team member, Peter Daszak, just said the hospital visit was an important opportunity to talk directly with medics who are on the ground at that critical time fighting COVID. The WHO has been kind of managing expectations. Michael Ryan, their emergencies director, said success is not measured necessarily in absolutely finding a source on the first mission. So he's warning against expecting too much. It's important to note that as the Chinese have warned, this is a very politicized. America wants to muster global opinion against China, so it'll be looking to use this visit to its advantage. China, meanwhile, of course, doesn't want a result that will make it look bad. And the team member Daszak has acknowledged this. He said that he's aware that this is a very sensitive working environment and that every side has something to lose in this investigation.
Indian farmers protesting against the government's controversial agricultural reforms have gone on a day-long mass hunger strike near the capital, New Delhi. Farm leaders say Saturday's hunger strike, coinciding with the death anniversary of the country's independence icon, Mahatma Gandhi, will show the protests are peaceful. Farmers have been holding rallies and sit-ins outside and inside the capital, New Delhi, for the last 4 months. They also held a tractor rally on this week's Republic Day that turned violent, leaving one dead and hundreds injured. The farmers want the government to repeal the legislation passed in September, arguing that it would leave them at the mercy of big corporations. The government claims that the measure is aimed at boosting rural incomes. Nearly a dozen rounds of talks between the two sides have failed to make a breakthrough. Eight Afghan security personnel are killed as a bomber drives a vehicle loaded with explosives into a military base in the country's east. The pre-dawn assault took place in the rest of the province of Nangarhar. The provincial council confirmed the attack but put the number of dead soldiers at 15. The Taliban militant group has claimed responsibility. The attack came 2 days after the Pentagon said that the Taliban were not living up to promises made in a deal signed with Washington last year. Under the agreement, the U.S. pledged to withdraw its forces from the country. In return, the Taliban agreed to not allow extremists to operate from the country and give some security guarantees. Violence has surged in recent months despite Doha peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government. Bangladesh has sent another batch of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, despite opposition from rights groups. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basan Char. It's the newest addition to the roughly 3,500 refugees already sent to the island since early December. Dhaka claims that it is only moving those who are willing to leave the overcrowded camps in the town of Cox's Bazar. However, humanitarian groups say the refugees have been forced to leave. The UN has also criticized the relocation, saying that the world body has not been allowed to even evaluate the living conditions on the flood-prone island. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims crossed into Bangladesh after Myanmar's military launched a brutal crackdown on the stateless ethnic minority group in 2017. The U.S. and South Korea plan to carry out joint military exercises this spring, drawing international calls for the drills to be suspended. Nearly 400 activist organizations in South Korea and around the world signed a joint statement calling on the new U.S. President Joe Biden to suspend the exercises, even as military officials in Seoul and Washington suggested the maneuvers would go ahead. Frank Smith has more from Seoul.
Joint military drills involving the U.S. and South Korea are scheduled to go ahead this spring, says South Korea's Minister of Defense and military officials under U.S. President Joe Biden. But nearly 400 NGOs around the world have signed a joint statement calling for the drills to be scrapped in the hopes of improving relations with North Korea and promoting a lasting peace. The annual exercises, some of which are computer-simulated war games, are viewed by Pyongyang as a threat and a rehearsal for invasion.
The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises have been suspended before, in the early 1990s, as Washington sought to improve relations with Pyongyang. Previous U.S. President Donald Trump also scaled back the drills following his first summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in 2018.
The North's Kim then pledged to suspend nuclear and long-range missile testing, with subsequent meetings between Kim and Trump failing to yield results or much for North Korea in return for its moratorium. U.S.-led sanctions against Pyongyang remain in place. South Korea keeps buying more advanced U.S. weapons, and now more military exercises are planned. Some activists view the war drills as counterproductive.
These South Korea-U.S. joint exercises fail to contribute to maintaining peace. Rather, it has been conducted in a way that threatens peace on the Korean Peninsula. It's now even more important because it's the beginning of the new Biden government in the United States and what signals can give to North Korea at this point.
North Korea has continued developing other military technologies, introducing a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a recent military parade. While seemingly committed to the drills, new U.S. officials have said they're reviewing North Korea policy, as experts call on Pyongyang to be patient. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The U.S. military has slammed recent Chinese military flights over the South China Sea as destabilizing. The U.S. military's Pacific Command says the flights over the past week are, quote, aggressive behavior. It says, however, the fighter jets pose no threat to a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier strike group in the region. The group led by USS Theodore Roosevelt entered the South China Sea recently amid tensions between China and Taiwan. Taipei last week reported an incursion by Chinese warplanes into its air defense identification zone. The U.S. condemned the alleged move, urging China to stop pressuring Taiwan. Beijing considers the self-ruled island as part of its territory and is critical of Washington's boosting ties with Taipei. The UN's Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty says 92 million people in the European Union still live in poverty.
The pandemic did increase inequalities and shall increase inequalities much further, because the peak of poverty figures will probably be reached in the autumn of 2021, when a large number of companies will fall bankrupt. But between 2008, 2009, and 2020, there was barely any change in the figures of inequality. So we've been growing, we've been creating jobs, but not reducing inequality significantly.
The shooter said 20% of the EU citizens are affected by poverty, while inequality levels have not improved since the year 2008 economic crisis. He said that even more troublesome is that the EU has a growing number of the working poor, people who work but are paid too low wages and thus are at risk of poverty. UN experts said the working poor make up 9% of the bloc's workforce, describing it as extremely problematic. Professor of Economics David Barkin says the European Union needs to rethink the about some of its economic structures to overcome its poverty crisis.
I think that the forces in Europe are moving in the direction of providing very, very small amounts of assistance that will not get to the root causes of the problem, which are the structure of production, the structure of employment, and the lack of a real reinvigoration of economic development that will direct itself toward attending the needs of the lower half of the populations. I think that there is a need for a mass political rethinking.
Italian workers have gone on a strike to protest over the government's handling of the COVID crisis. Max Civelli has more.
Public and private sector workers staged a nationwide 24-hour general strike to denounce government measures adopted to counter the spread of coronavirus disease in Italy. The industrial action, called by the Confederation of Base Unions, COBAS, was joined by public servants and self-employed workers in several cities, including Milan, Rome, and Naples. In a note, unions have explained that the ongoing health crisis has exacerbated a structural crisis of the capitalist economy, with a generalized impoverishment and a worsening of living conditions for millions of male and female workers. Also, students and teachers of Italian high schools held rallies in Rome and other cities, demanding a prompt return to the classroom after almost 10 months of remote learning.
We are staging a protest to reiterate that schools must be a priority in this country. Just a small amount of the recovery fund is destined to the school system. Students are sick and tired of distance learning and are dropping out of schools. Many are falling victim to depression.
Students across Italy have been holding demonstrations, open-air lessons and strikes in protest over the adoption of the distance learning policy by the government in response to a second wave of COVID-19 in October. About 10 million students have been affected by coronavirus restrictions in Italy, while schools have remained open in most European countries.
We demand more classrooms, transport to school and better access to education. Distance learning is not working. Many families cannot afford providing digital devices to their children to attend internet lessons regularly. Our families get poorer by the day as our parents lose their job.
As if the COVID crisis and its grave effects on the Italians weren't enough, Italy has also been hit by a political crisis, with Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte resigning earlier this week, forcing the country's head of state to start a round of formal consultations with all political groups to establish if a new government majority can be formed.
Talks between Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and party leaders to resolve the government crisis concluded on Friday, with the country on the brink of a crashing socio-economic failure. President Mattarella must now decide on the way forward and ensure Italy a new government. Max Civelli, Rome.
And that is for World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Europe is facing an accelerating health, economic and political crisis amid high coronavirus infection rates, hospitalizations and deaths in many countries. The European economy remains largely in lockdown. More infectious virus variants are spreading. Mexico surpassed India in coronavirus-related deaths with about 1,506 new fatalities on Thursday, 28th of January. We're prepared for your A report written by staff writers at the Reuters news agency under the heading Europe's Crisis Accelerates, Mexico's Virus Toll Now World's Third. Stay with us for more of the Reuters news agency report. Mexico overtakes India with the third highest number of coronavirus fatalities after the United States and Brazil. In Europe, countries consider imposing new restrictions as a new variant of COVID-19 that initially emerged in Britain continues to rise across the European continent. Mexico surpassed India in coronavirus-related deaths with about 1,506 new fatalities on Thursday, 28th of January 2021. The additional deaths pushed the total number of fatalities in Mexico to 155,145. Mexico's health ministry also reported 18,617 new confirmed cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number to 1,825,519 across the North American country. In Mexico City, hospitals are nearing capacity, and a shortage of oxygen tanks has complicated the treatment of COVID-19 patients. According to a Reuters tally, India, a country with a population more than 10 times that of Mexico, has reported a total death toll of about 154,000. According to Deputy Health Minister Hugo López-Gatell, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who said he had tested positive for COVID-19 himself recently, is now improving. The president has so far resisted imposing mandatory lockdowns to curb the spread of COVID-19. Europe is facing an accelerating health, economic and political crisis. Amid high infection rates, hospitalizations and deaths in many countries, the European economy remains largely in lockdown. More infectious virus variants are spreading across the European continent. The French health minister, Olivier Véran, said recently the government's current restrictive measures in France are becoming ineffective because the number of cases of new variant of COVID-19 keeps steadily rising. Olivier Véran said the new variant constituted 3.2% of total positive cases at the beginning of January, but that figure has increased to about 1 in 10 of all cases. Olivier Véran said from 500 cases then, we are today at more than 2,000 cases daily, adding that new variants of the virus are the worrying parameter as they are more contagious. Olivier Véran warned about the emergence of a pandemic within the pandemic as the new variant of COVID-19 is circulating more widely and is spreading faster every week. The French health minister added the effectiveness of the curfew is now waning. According to the latest figures, the number of new COVID-19 cases reached a record high of about 27,000 by the end of Thursday evening, 28th of January. An additional 350 deaths were also reported. The country, with a total number of 3,166,145 infection cases and 74,601 fatalities, has been under almost a year-long lockdown to combat the pandemic. The French government spokesman, Gabriel Attal, said the French government is considering scenarios ranging from maintaining the current framework to a very tight containment policy. According to the most recent opinion polls, this has raised the possibility of a third lockdown in France in less than 12 months. The country went into lockdown twice last year, the first between March and May, and the second between October and December. French government is now cautious that a third lockdown could spark angry protests similar to the protests which took place in the Netherlands recently. Protests hit the Netherlands against coronavirus lockdown measures, the first ever curfew since the Second World War, with the Dutch police using tear gas and water cannon to disperse angry protesters. Police have arrested hundreds of people during days of unrest over the past 2 weeks in cities across the Netherlands, where protesters set fire and violently clashed with members of the security forces. Social media users in France have started calling for civil disobedience using the hashtag Je ne me reconnaîtrai pas, I will not go back into lockdown, on Twitter. The United Kingdom has also seen several anti-lockdown protests as millions of people have long been living under restrictive measures. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson warned lately that tough measures may continue into the spring and even beyond into the summer. Some 24 million people, representing 43% of Britain's population, are currently living under lockdown in the United Kingdom. Under the restrictions, non-essential shops, hairdressers and gymnasiums remain closed. The order also includes a warning to stay at home, placing a limit on household mixing to two people outdoors. According to the Johns Hopkins University, the pandemic has so far infected a total number of 3,760,000 people and killed over 103,000 others across the United Kingdom. According to the foreign policy magazine, Europe finds itself in an economic and political explosive situation. The foreign policy magazine said on Friday, 29th of January, that the European continent will not be able to reopen its economy expeditiously, at least not without a ruinous death toll. It added, there will also not be any quick fixes in the coming weeks, as complex vaccine manufacturing capacity cannot be magically conjured up overnight. Amid the crisis, the World Health Organization, WHO, launched an investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic in the Chinese city of Wuhan on Friday, 29th of January, 2021. The World Health Organization sent a team of investigators to Wuhan, China, where the first ever coronavirus infection was reported. The team of experts met with a group of Chinese scientists in the central Chinese city of Wuhan ahead of a series of field visits to hospitals, to laboratories, and the now closed Huanan market, which was said to have been the link between the first cases of the coronavirus infection. The World Health Organization said in a tweet, all hypotheses are on the table as the team follows the science in their work to understand the origin of the COVID-19 virus. It urged China to provide the team of investigators with the support, access and data that they need. Earlier this month, the World Health Organization technical lead on the disease, Maria van Kerkhove, said, the world may never find patient zero in its search for the origins of the coronavirus. The emergence of the coronavirus in Wuhan, China, has prompted the US and some other allies to claim that the virus had originated in the laboratory in the Chinese city of Wuhan and blamed China for the spread of the disease. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki said recently that it was imperative we get to the bottom of how the coronavirus appeared and spread worldwide. White House spokesman Jen Psaki urged a robust and clear investigation into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic, alleging that there might have been some misinformation from some sources in China.
the debate.
The European Union and British-based pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca have become embroiled in a fierce row over the supply of coronavirus vaccines. The European Commission says that the Anglo-Swedish firm is not honoring its contract to provide a specific number of shots. AstraZeneca has said it will not be able to deliver as many vaccines to the EU as initially hoped because of a production glitch, a claim disputed by the EU. The company announced the initial deliveries would be approximately 31 million doses, far less than the anticipated 80 million. To make things even more complicated, the EU confirmed new bans on certain vaccine exports from the continent to cover the supply shortages. Blocking the shipment of vaccines made within Europe will most likely cause a broader disruption of vaccine supplies, not just for the UK, but for numerous countries around the world.
The first coronavirus case was reported some 1 year ago in Europe. No one at a time would have imagined the massive scale of death and devastation it would wreak on the continent and around the globe. Nearly 30 million cases and 700,000 deaths have been registered in Europe alone since the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak. The actual numbers, however, are set to be much higher given the fact that many infection cases have gone unnoticed. Just days ago, the UK became the first European country to crest a grim milestone of 100,000 deaths. This is while economic powerhouse Germany continues to report daily deaths of around 1,000. Less populated countries have not been immune either. Portugal, with a population of 10 million, currently has the world's highest per capita 7-day averages of both new cases and deaths. COVID-19 and problems surrounding the disease have been compounded by the spread of more infectious and deadlier strains of the virus. The continent has been struggling to contain the pandemic despite imposing lockdowns and strict curbs, including border closures. The World Health Organization says it's too early to ease the restrictions. The UN Health Agency's European branch says transmission rates across Europe are still very high, impacting health systems and straining services. However, the lockdowns in several cases met with opposition and dissatisfaction among the public, sparking protests across the continent. Ironically, even the development of vaccines has failed to alleviate concerns. In fact, frustration is growing in the European Union after a second coronavirus vaccine manufacturer warned of supply issues to the bloc. After a cut in deliveries of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine slowed some nations' inoculation programs, AstraZeneca dealt a fresh blow by saying the number of initial doses available would be lower than expected due to production problems. The EU Health Commissioner has expressed, quote, deep dissatisfaction as millions of lives have been put at risk.
Points in all of this all along was the issue of transparency, and we had EU lawmakers and so on accusing the European Commission of showing a lack of transparency in terms of its dealings with the pharmaceutical companies. And now we have a situation where the European Commission is accusing the pharmaceutical companies of showing a lack of transparency.
COVID-19 has relentlessly battered Europe for nearly a year. Lives have been lost and livelihoods have been destroyed. But the pandemic has also had other impacts, exposing Europe's frailties, not only in its poor preparations and medical responses, but in its leadership dysfunctionality and disunity.
Joining us on this edition of The Debate, we have author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer. Joining us from London, also, we have senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, who is joining us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Fryer in London. AstraZeneca, they're blaming a production fault for this delay. What do you think is really going on in this supply row?
Well, I think we should believe what AstraZeneca is saying is that unfortunately they've not been able to produce as much of the vaccine as many countries wanted. We should note that the European Union only approved the AstraZeneca vaccine today, whereas Britain did that some weeks ago. And, of course, Britain got in much earlier with its orders than the European Union, so received quite a good amount of vaccines from AstraZeneca and also of the Pfizer-BioNTech, which is mainly made in Belgium, which is why Britain has managed to vaccinate, at least with the first dose, about 8 million people already, which is way ahead of all the other EU 27 member states. So there's quite a lot of frustration on the European continent that actually they've been caught napping on this, that they are way behind what they would have hoped, and certainly way behind the British, although, of course, Britain does have the worst cases, the number of deaths of any country in Europe.
Mr. Williams, in New York, what do you think about the issue? Our guest in London believes that this is probably just a glitch. There are contrary beliefs to that as well. Is the British-based AstraZeneca misleading the European Union, in your opinion?
Well, it's not misleading. It might have been rosily optimistic in the contracts it signed. And there are big dilemmas here. I mean, Britain is no longer in the European Union. But even if it were, the British government would have a hard time saying, oh, we're making these vaccines here, but the company has a contract with the European Union. So they've got to go to the European Union and drive past dying people in Britain. It's a political dilemma that's not an easily reconcilable one. And we saw that with Donald Trump when he tried to sequestrate supplies of vaccines made by in Europe and other places for America. You know, the politicians will want to look after their own voters first. Not necessarily their own people, but their own voters, definitely. And, you know, in many ways, I think it's not often I boost pharmaceutical companies, but it is worth realizing that this production of a vaccine within a year of the serious onset of the epidemic is pretty much a landmark in modern medicine. Most vaccines take years, decades to produce. The fact that within a year they've got three or four workable vaccines going, I actually had my first shot here in New York a week ago, and I'm hoping to have the other one next week. But it's a remarkable achievement in its way. Where it falls down is in the delivery, and you know, there you have to compare Europe, for example, which actually has a sort of a more rational health system, even the separate countries do, compared with the US, where it tends to be chaotic. And there's apart from you know, it depends on the states, and some states have a rational distribution method. And others, you've seen, you know, occasions where the vaccines go missing or go to the wrong people, or they can't get to the people who really need them, because there's no machinery for mass inoculation. Even in Britain, it's not the same machinery there was a few years ago, when the National Health Service had massive inoculation campaigns for TB and other ailments. So that's somewhat fallen by. You know, we have to give credit where it's due to those companies that have produced the vaccine and the universities that are involved as well, of course, because there's a lot of government money involved in here. Well, you know, the companies will take the credit if it wins, but the fact that they were promised their investment back by lots of governments will tend to get overlooked.
Sure.
And this is very much a public-private partnership.
Mr. Fryer, let's address the elephant in the room. That was also mentioned by Mr. Williams in New York. Is Brexit playing a role in all of this?
I don't think Brexit is directly playing a role, but indirectly it is. There is unfortunately a very sour relationship between the EU 27 and Britain at the moment, not because of Brexit, but because of what has happened since Brexit, in particular the way that the British government has been accusing the EU of not handling the post-Brexit situation properly, and in particular calling in what they see as vaccine nationalism or COVID nationalism, which is where individual European countries are at each other's throats because of the COVID situation. And in particular, there is the problem about Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland, which is a province of the United Kingdom, nonetheless has remained within the single market of the European Union in order to be able to trade freely with the Republic of Ireland, the most of the island of Ireland. But there is a huge row today where the First Minister of the Northern Ireland administration, who was very much pro-Brexit, has really said that the EU is acting like a bully by threatening to cut off supplies of COVID vaccines to Northern Ireland, whereas according to the EU plans for the single market, it ought not to do that. But I think we also have to bear in mind the important fact that health matters are what's called national competence. In other words, this is a responsibility of national governments, not of the EU as such. And this is really the first time that the European Union has tried, despite that fact, to introduce a Europe-wide vaccine policy to get vaccines to everyone. But it hasn't properly worked, and individual states, we heard earlier how Hungary has put in orders for China and Russia, and other countries have put their orders wherever they feel vaccines will come. But it is rather a chaotic mess at the moment, all against the backdrop of a real crisis in the health situation, an understandable worry about people right across Europe about when and if they will actually get their vaccine.
Ian Williams, so let's basically look at it this from this vantage point. If there's a market there right now and the demand is there and the European countries, as you also mentioned, have invested billions in the vaccine development, despite the strong demand, why is there a lack of doses? Do you think that vaccines produced within the EU might be going to higher bidders outside of the bloc?
Well, they might well do under normal, but I don't think so. I think what we're looking at is, there are contracts to be fulfilled. The European Union has altruistically entered into agreements with other countries across the world to supply vaccines under the COVAX agreement. There are commitments here, and it's, some of them are quite altruistic. But also, it's in the nature of the way things are now that you have highly centralized production, and all it takes is a glitch in one factory, one line to go, and vaccine production is out for the whole continent. So the centralization of production might lead to greater efficiency, might lead to efficiencies of scale on one side, but it also diminishes the resilience of the whole production process. So one glitch in one production line can stop the whole continental supply, whereas at one time it would have been just a regional problem.
Mr. Farr, what about the overall policies of European countries in dealing with the COVID-19 outbreak? Despite the restrictions and the lockdowns, cases are still on the rise. Unfortunately, fatalities are still increasing. The economy has suffered immensely. What went wrong in the equation? The lockdowns, as we know, saw a lot of protests across Europe. The recent ones in Netherlands also turned violent.
That's true. Of course, I think we need to recognize that the anti-lockdown groups, protesters, are a minority and, frankly, acting against the interests of majority of the people who understand perfectly well why there have to be lockdowns, why there have to be restrictions of various kinds. But Europe has really suffered unfairly in many ways from the fact that there is freedom of movement, so not in the normal times people can circulate around Europe perfectly freely, and indeed Europeans travel all over the world. Earlier there was mention made of Portugal and the particularly sad cases that we're seeing now in Portugal, and that's largely because it's a bridge really to Brazil and other parts of South America, and the new variant, the Brazilian variant, has come in to Europe via Portugal and is now seen in several member states of the European Union and as well as here in Britain. So although border restrictions are being brought in, indeed Britain has brought in travel restrictions against quite a number of countries, including the UAE is the latest to be added to the list. That, in a sense, is shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, because the infections have spread so fast and so far in Europe, because basically Europeans move around a great deal and they mix with people from all over the world.
Mr. Williams, I saw you nodding there. Would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I was just thinking back. I was looking at the list of things today, and it was about a year ago that the British government, just being, you know, echoing Trump, was being somewhat dismissive of it, and they allowed 3,000 football fans to fly from Spain to Liverpool, when Spain, Madrid was at the height of an epidemic. I mean, there's been a complete lack of common sense precautions by the British government on many ways, and it's one of the things that's led to this skepticism that we're just talking about. I mean, you can understand people being skeptical when they're told, first of all, the masks are necessary, then they're not necessary, and then you begin to suspect that the real reason they want people not to wear masks is because they're short of them, and they want to reserve them for particular occupations like the hospitals. So, you know, there's been a lack of transparency by governments, not just in Europe, but all over the world. It's, you know, in some parts of the world, they've locked up journalists for reporting about it. Egypt was deporting a Guardian journalist for reporting accurately on the Khajiits. So you can understand that there's a lot of skepticism. I mean, it's almost unpardonable, the cranks, the anti-vaxxers and the anti-lockdowners who are gathering in large infectious numbers on the streets of cities across Europe to protest measures taken to ensure their health. But you can see why they would be skeptical. Governments have bred that skepticism. Right across the world, governments have given people very good reason to doubt them. And there's also that ever-present suspicion that no government will leave a crisis like this untended to, in terms of restricting people's liberties, keeping an eye on people, scrutinizing them. So, you know, travel restrictions, wow, great. It's not even national borders. Remember, people are being arrested for driving from one city to another inside Britain and inside Europe. People are being arrested for driving on the hills. And the point is, of course, this is, of its necessity, is going to be capricious. The police will be arresting people who they don't like. And we know who the police tend not to like in societies like Britain and America. They tend not to like minorities, and they suspect them of spreading disease more than anyone else. So, you know, the statistics come out. These strain society in a big way. It's not just the European Union where the fracture lines are showing. It's inside countries as well.
Sure.
And governments have encouraged this. Governments have done it because their behavior has led to understandable suspicion on the part of the public.
And Jonathan Fryer, touching on a point that was just mentioned by our guest in New York, fraction lines are just beginning to emerge. Speaking of that, Hungary has become the first EU member to approve the Chinese-made Sinopharm vaccine. It means that Hungary continues to diverge from the EU, as last week Budapest approved Russia's Sputnik V vaccine. So essentially, this shortfall is pushing the bloc to a crisis point where, despite all the money invested in European countries, now EU countries are turning elsewhere to get what they need.
Yes, of course, that is true. And we have to bear in mind the fact that the EU paid up front hundreds of millions of euros in order to get doses of the vaccines, including the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, which is why there is the current row at the moment. They've said, we paid for it, we've signed a contract, where is the vaccine? It should be here by now, and it isn't. As you was mentioned in your introduction, basically there's a shortfall of about 50 million doses out of 80 million, which is a serious shortfall. But I'd like to echo Ian's comments about the pathetic messaging, really confusing messaging, that's come out from several governments, not least the British government, about this. And this is largely because we have a Prime Minister here, Boris Johnson, who is a libertarian who believes that people should be asked to do things, not told to do things, and that it should be as free as possible to do what they like. And whereas in principle that's all very well, in a pandemic situation it's pretty catastrophic, and I think this is why the British people have been confused by this messaging, the ridiculous promise that the Prime Minister made that we'd be able to have Christmas with our loved ones in December, what turned out to be a dreadful mistake and has led to the recent rise in cases here. So it is a complicated situation, but inevitably member states of the European Union, the 27 member states, are sovereign states. They're quite entitled to make their own arrangements if they want to get other vaccines in, as Hungary is doing from China and Russia. But the European Union, having paid for vaccines from AstraZeneca and others, would like to see those arrive as soon as possible. Though, as I mentioned earlier, I think there really is a genuine problem in actual production at the moment.
Ian Williams, here's a different perspective. We have wealthy countries arguing over the vaccine. The poorer countries are not even getting a glimpse of what they need. So what's the situation going to be like for the poor and lower income countries of the world? We know this is a global pandemic, and if it's to end, it has to end globally.
Well, I have to give some credit to the European Union there. They have made serious efforts with the COVAX program to attempt to make sure that supplies are available for other countries. But naturally, they have taxpayers. The taxpayers have put this money up, their taxpayers, and they want first dibs in it. The fact that the European Union is allowing vaccines to go to other countries, even while people at home are clamoring for them, is, you know, that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be. We should encourage that. But there is a sense of responsibility here, and I just want to pick up where Jonathan left. In an older golden days of British responsibility and politics, any other Prime Minister would have handed in his resignation after presiding over a series of decisions that cost tens of thousands of his constituents' lives. And the fact that Johnson is still there, still unabashed, and still unresigned, I think, shows that we are dealing with a completely different degree of political responsibility now.
All right, we're gonna have to leave it there. Mr. Williams, I'm sorry we're running short of time for this program. Allow me to thank my guest, author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer, joining us from London. Also thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, speaking to us from New York. Also a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question which is very important, and that is this. Why is it that God has the sole authority to legislate and formulate laws? It's a question that often comes up in discussions today. Why is it that human beings can't form laws on their own and legislate and formulate laws as they so desire? In order to answer this question, we must understand, first of all, that lordship, or as we say in Arabic, rububiyat, is divided into two distinct categories. There is the cosmological lordship or authority, and there is a religious authority, and an authority, a conventional authority. The proofs that we have that God is ontologically and cosmologically the Lord and regulator of the world prove that he is the sole being and only being that has the authority to legislate and regulate the affairs of the human beings in a conventional manner. Now, why is this so? Because legislation and the formulation of laws is a type of regulation and management over the affairs of human beings and human society, on one hand. On the other hand, just like rule and governance and the authority just like it is also a type of governance and an authority over the over the wealth and lives of human beings. Obviously, if you're legislating a law, right, it means that you have a certain authority over the life of this person. Like, for example, if you say that if somebody kills another human being, he should also be killed, you're formulating this law.